Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Marwood. Must be Berardi. Oh, what a brilliant save! How did he deflect that? Because I don't believe that Berardi actually hit it very hard, which in a curious way might have made it more difficult. Spinning away, and Southall able to parry the ball out of harm's way. Time at all. A reflection on the save. The pressure is maintained by Wednesday. Mark Smith trying to get through the crowd. Marwood. Another corner. Got a deflection. No congestion on the near post. On by Lyons. Brilliant save again. And then one off the crossbar. First from Smith, the second from Marwood. Unbelievable stuff. Seen such intense pressure applied by a football team, and Everton are really suffering at the moment. Another corner. Southall has made two quite remarkable saves and was helped out by the crossbar.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and what a guest we've got for you on this edition. Before I introduce him, first of all, though, my two partners in crime for this one, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, welcome.
Oh, how are we doing, Stu?
Good. Looking forward to it?
Oh, very much so. Even as a Red, how could you not?
Excellent. And second guest, Mr. Paul McParlan, as a Blue, must be looking forward to it.
I've been looking forward to this since I first heard about it. I cannot wait to get going today.
Brilliant. So, obviously, you'll hear less and less from us, which is great. And now to the guest. For me, the greatest goalkeeper in my lifetime, and certainly one of the all-time greats of the British game. Synonymous with being the last line of defence in Howard Kendall's superb Everton side of the 1980s, playing over 575 games for the blue half of Merseyside, representing Wales 92 occasions, and the author, which for me is a stunning new biography, and it's to me, it takes the footballer's biography into the 21st century and actually deals with the contemporary issues of the modern game. Here to talk about mind games, the ups and downs of life and football, Mr. Neville Southall. Thank you very, very much for agreeing to chat to us.
Pleasure, mate. All of you, I should say.
Thank you. So first of all, like I just said on there, the book is... to me, it's groundbreaking. It's quite a grand statement, but it's so out of the ordinary for a footballer's biography. What made you write it now, and why did you go for the sort of why did you try and tackle the subjects that you've tried to tackle?
Well, to be fair, it wasn't my idea. It was HarperCollins that actually approached me and asked me if I wanted to do it. Based on what I do on my Twitter. It's not really a biography, I wouldn't say that. I sort of get it as just my thoughts, really, on things as they are, or as they have been through my career. So I wouldn't class it as a biography, it's just really my rambling thoughts, basically.
they're wonderful, wonderful rambling thoughts, I have to say. I suppose for me then, just not so much the first question, but as you brought up Twitter then, and myself and the guys were chatting earlier, your presence on social media, you know, for me, when I first sort of came across you on Twitter, I had to just double check that it wasn't a parody account, because your sort of observations of the game, your observations of society are so sort of on point and so far removed from what most footballers most footballers comment on. Do you see, you know, are you sort of glad that social media is here and it allows for people like yourself to put your thoughts forward?
Yeah, look, if I'm really honest, I don't really care whether you like them or not, in all fairness.
Well, no, that's fair enough.
So it's my account and I put on what I want. If people like it, that's great. If they don't, which there seems to be a lot of them, then that's fine too. It doesn't really matter. It just is what I want to put on and what I'm interested in. And I don't worry too much about anything else apart from just putting on what I like. I don't set out to do anything in particular. The things I cover is because of the things I don't know, really. The only thing I have discovered is that there's things that I don't know. Well, there's a lot of things I don't know. But I now know I don't know.
Yeah. Always helpful. Stephen?
Excellent. No, brilliant. I'm interested to know, Neville, that, you know, as a goalkeeper, you know, do you think that goalkeepers traditionally view life in a more pragmatic manner? You know, I'm looking at kind of like your playing days, where your early days at Everton were spent in a competitive manner against Jim Arnold before becoming the undisputed number one at Everton, you know, with a very good backup in Bobby Mims as well. But, you know, having looked at, you know, a complete polar opposite in, say, Peter Shilton, you know, again, you know, opinions that people will sometimes find polarising in a completely different manner. He's still honest in his approach. And I think, you know, do you think it's a theme amongst goalkeepers? Is that something you ever thought about?
Well, I think it's about responsibility. I think, and if we had somebody in number 10 who took as much responsibility as a goalkeeper, we'd be all right. Well, we haven't, sadly. I think, look, there's a thing where you have to rely on 10 other people. There's a time when you have to get them out of the mire, and there's a time when they'll do it for you. But in all fairness, when you make a mistake, it's there for everybody to see, and it's how you get over the mistakes. And I think you have to be strong enough to say, well, look, I can't be perfect every game. Because nobody can. I can't even be perfect, you know, for the first half. You're always going to do something that you could have done better. So I think it's how you set your mind out, really. You know, say if we're playing against Liverpool, say, when we'd have a different challenge. You know, they put the ball in behind it. There's a lot better quality. If we're playing against Wimbledon, then they know, you know, they're going to throw like 300 balls in the box as soon as they possibly can. And you're not going to be able to catch everyone or punch everyone cleanly. So it's working out what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, and taking responsibility for your decisions. And the better the decision makers, the better the goalkeepers. And I think that's true in life, really.
Excellent, excellent. So yeah, it's a case of kind of like, it's like the way you have to approach your goalkeeping is being a good grounding to kind of like approaching life in general.
Well, can you be anybody else but yourself?
Exactly, exactly.
So I think you have to be yourself. And I look at players these days and I don't think they're allowed to be themselves. Well, that's, people keep telling me there's no characters about. Well, there is. But basically, they're like actors. You never see them off screen unless you know them personally. And that to me is a shame. That's taking someone out of the game. So you have to be who you are. And your personality should come through on the pitch, really. And if you go to the managers will try and get the players to play in the same philosophy as his. And what you normally find is the players are a reflection of the manager, what style he wants and how they want to play. You know, you think of, you know, Howard coming into Everton, really, he knew what Everton was about. They wanted to have outstanding players with a fantastic will to win, but could play good football, but could also kick people off the park if necessary, because both is necessary. And I think if you look at Alex Ferguson, you know, how many goals did they score late on? Was it him hassling the referee, or was it, you know, the way the players were? You know, you look at Klopp now, he's got them playing in such a way, they're buying into that philosophy. So the team is very much a reflection on the manager, I think, on the manager's personality. And you know, we've seen with Everton in the past that the personality is either a bit dull or not quite getting across.
Fantastic.
Paul, for you?
Hi, Neville. Delighted to speak to you. Remember your debut game against Aston Villa, I think it was, December 1981. And yeah, I think we won 2-0 that day.
It was 2-1, but you got everything else right.
But yeah, I mean...
You've done your homework.
Well, I was there, so I remember these things. Yeah. I've been a season ticket over 40 years, so yeah, definitely. But, I mean, you're using your boot to kind of show how your experience from football can help people to improve their own lives, get themselves noticed. And going back to when you signed for Everton, you were famously part of Howard Kendall's Magnificent Seven. And without being critical, you're probably the least well-billed of the signings that Kendall made during that window. Obviously, he bought Jim Ardle, who Stephen mentioned before, who was his goalkeeper from Blackburn Rovers. So looking back at your footballing career, what qualities do you think you had then that enabled you to succeed, whereas none of the other Magnificent Seven really did?
Well, if you look at the Magnificent Seven film, quite a lot of them got shot anyway, didn't they? So... I think naivety was one, because, you know, I suppose you could look at it as a massive move for me, but my actual thought was really, well, I'll give it a go because I can always go back to Bury.
Yeah.
And it was as simple as that, really. And then when I got there, I thought, well, I want to be in the first team by Christmas, or there's no point in me being here. Because I didn't probably realise the gap in terms of quality, really, and in terms of how everything did things. But, you know, I went to Bury from Winsford United on less money than I was odd carrying.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, I can go to Bury, and if it doesn't work out, I can go back odd carrying. I've got to Bury now. Yeah, I think I can play in this division, fourth division now. I moved on to Everton, so that means I can play in the fourth division anyway. So I always had a safety net, really. I can go back to what it was, but I have to go and see if I can do it. So for me, it was like, once I'm there now, I want to get in the team. And once I get in the team, I want to be the best player or the best person I can possibly be in my position, because I think that's, what am I going into work for otherwise? What am I going into work to waste my time? It didn't seem any point in doing that. So if you're going to go in and do what you're supposed to do, then you have to maximise what you've got. And, you know, there was lots of things I wasn't great at, but there was things I was good at, and I tried to work on the things I was bad at and emphasise the things I was good at. And I think that's what most people do in their lives anyway. You know, you find a particular talent for doing something. There's, even within that, there's bits of your job that you don't like. The good bits compensate. You know, at Everton, it was great. Could I play now? I could play on the pitch. Could I be part of it off the pitch? Not a chance. Because it's far too regimented, far too formal, and far too many people telling me what to do. And I would have probably asked for the transfer within the first 2 weeks, and I would have had it written in my contract that I wouldn't listen to anybody else unless I respected them. And I couldn't play now. I could play on the pitch. I wouldn't have a problem on the pitch, but off the pitch, not a chance. Because they give the wrong answers to everybody. They're telling people now what they can't do. Yeah. And they're not telling people what they can do, sorry.
So do you think, Neville, these days that the modern football is coached not to give an opinion?
Well, they are coached because everyone's frightened of their image. And it is corporate, so the image is everything. But I do think we also built a culture of telling people what they can't do, and that's a very dangerous culture. You know, we can't possibly win the league. We can't possibly play four games a month. You can't possibly last 90 minutes. You must be tired. You can't possibly train, you know, for too long, because you'll get tired for Saturday. And I think that's why people get fed up with it. And I'm not sure whether. I don't think the players like it too much. You know, the players are coached and coached nowadays because the manager doesn't want to leave their decisions to them on a Saturday or whenever the game is these days. And I think it's took character, it's took personality out of the game, where, you know, when you look at it now, there's probably younger lads playing than ever before. So they should have more of a freedom to go and play. And I think that's why... you know, you get some of the younger ones coming through who've got a bit of personality, and within 2 years, it seems to be knocked out of them. And I think that's, for me, to be good at anything, you have to be yourself, because you can't go around and try and be something else you're not. And if you can't be allowed to be yourself, there's no point in doing a job unless you have to do it. Or you're never going to be what you're supposed to be, because people have drowned you. And I think a lot of that is happens in football. You know, oh, you're scared of your image, you can't do this. So, okay. And I do believe if you've got a natural spirit and a natural determination to be something, then you should be allowed to be it and not be forced backwards. And a lot of it, I think, is telling people the wrong things. You know, you've trained for an hour, now you need to come in. Oh, sod off, how do you get any better? Yeah. Do you know, and that's the thing for me is how do you improve? You know, how much time do you need to spend on improvements? And how much time do they get these days? Because we've built a culture around the clubs. And in some cases, you know, it's right, because obviously you need to protect the players. But in some ways, it's wrong. And I look at the other sports, and, you know, I look at tennis. How can Andy Murray play a five-set game over 5 hours? But funny enough, he don't come off. Well, he gets a little rest in between, but most players rest. They don't sprint everywhere, do they? They don't go at the top of the game everywhere, so they rest. So what is going wrong? You know, I look at it, players can't last 90 minutes. Why? You've got the best sports people there. Mentally, they're not at it. Why not? You've got the best psychologists. So maybe we should be looking at recruiting different psychologists and different fitness people to start with in the first place, and start telling them that they can achieve. Imagine going into the SAS and they tell you the first day, well, you know, we've got to train hard this morning, but you can't cope, so just do half a morning. It don't happen. To get better at anything, you need to put the time and effort in. And I think a lot of the players these days are stifled in that. And I think that's wrong. We need to start giving messages. Because if you do that in the first team, and your kids are looking at you in the academy when they're, you know, even as young as six, and the message is, you can't do this, you can't do that, stick to doing this, then it doesn't give them that ambition. And if you look at the players now, tell me three real good leaders in the Premier League on the pitch. Can you think of three?
I can't think of any who are playing for Everton at the moment, Neville.
There's none who play for Hull City.
You look at natural born leaders who have personalities, because that's what they need, and they have a drive, and they're there to make decisions on the pitch. Now, we had a team full of people who were incredibly annoying at times, and incredibly vocal, but all wanted to win, and they would do anything to win, even if it might upset anybody else. And I look at some of the teams now, and I'm thinking, I don't see that. And when you go on the pitch, in your contract, it says you have to give the best you possibly can. Now, for me, Messi and Ronaldo, the two best players in the world, first and foremost, work. Now, if you're any sort of player, you will look at them two and go, they're the best two players in the world. I wonder why that is. Well, first, they work hard, and they work hard every single game. Then they demand so much of themselves that they won't be either put off by the opposition, never be the worst on the pitch, always contribute something. Whatever it is, they contribute in every match. And that's what you should be sticking up on your board when you're training. Be like him. Be consistent like him. And if everybody in Everton is a 9 out of 10, we won't be far off winning everything. At the moment, we've had 4s, 5s, 6s, 7s, 8s and 9s. And that's why we haven't been successful.
I wouldn't even rate them that highly, Neville. But I mean, go back to what you said.
I'm being kind.
Yeah, you've been very kind there. And I know your views don't go down too well with the Everton boardroom at the moment as well, which is really unfortunate. But going back to what you said there about leadership qualities, I mean, would you say when the likes of Andy Gray and Peter Reid came into that dressing room, they showed the type of qualities you were talking about?
Well, yeah, because they just want to win. Adrian Eve was a nightmare. He just moaned all the way through the game. But he just mumbled about everything. And you think, okay, he wants everything perfect. Great. Would I rather have that than somebody come along and go, actually, we can settle for this. And it's, you know, it's not a time for that. It's a time for saying, you know, there's 90 minutes here. If we all fall out, we all fall out. But the end thing is the end thing, and we want to win. And as long as I know Adrian Heath was a pain in the arse in the game, but he's a great fella off it, who cares? It's his way of coping and getting through the game. Mm-hmm. Everybody's different, so you need to find a way of harnessing that. And luckily, we had a team who could do that. Some were incredibly dry sense of humour, some were incredibly cutting, some were just funny, some were like Bales, who were just daft. Underneath all of that, there was a will to win. So yes, we really enjoyed it, but there was a bond in there that if you hurt one, you'd hurt everybody. And I think, you know, that's the main thing for us, is that we could say and do whatever we wanted to do to each other inside, but outside we protect everybody.
Do you feel never that, you know, that team ethos that they has in the mid-80s, famously that those Chinese meals in Southport and an Allison that you had to bond the team together, do you think they were, you know, they were the crucial factor in getting the team gelling as a team?
Well, that's as it seems. I would just said, look, they'll all get pissed. and then when you're pissed, you tell the truth. And it's off everybody's chest.
But of course, you didn't drink, so it must have been different for you looking in from the outside.
Yeah, maybe. Or maybe you just thought I'd do all right anyway, so it don't matter.
He's probably correct there.
But he also knew that I had to give somebody a lift home, so I was fine. Yeah, look, I think it's a good thing. I think sometimes the Chinese, if you think about it, was a tap, and that tap released pressure. And once you turn that tap on and things get said, everyone's pissed, but they say it. And whether you remember it the next day or not, it's off that fella's chest. Everybody else has heard it. You move on. Funny enough, we never lost a game after the Chinese.
Yeah, wasn't that a famous spiel in the 86-87 season when Wimbledon had knocked us out of the FA Cup and how it got everyone together to say, right, you know, we've really got to come back from this?
Yeah, I think Howard never get to recognition he deserves. He was far better psychologist than ever anyone's ever given credit for. Look, he brought in somebody alongside him, Colin, who hated to lose, no matter what it was. You know, if you counted the beans on your plate and you had one more than him, you weren't happy. Not because he wanted an extra beat, but because he wanted to win. You know, he was just like that. He brought in a role model, if you like, who some of the other lads had grown up with as well. So he brought in somebody that you could would never let anybody rest. Then you had Howard, who would try and ensnare you in his office in the afternoons to have a quiet drink and talk about football. But as a partnership, it worked really, really well, because, you know, Colin was a bit snappier than Howard, but you could see that their understanding of themselves, even in the dressing room, must have been something on the pitch to watch and behold, because of what they had. You know, you had Bowley alongside them too. It must have been incredible to actually be involved in that three. So we had two of the best midfield players, I think, that Everton's ever produced in charge of us, who knew what Everton's way was. Never complicated, really. We never went anywhere and said, we'll tell you what, we'll come for a draw. He never did that, ever. Never did that. We might play a little bit more and give the opposition a little bit more of the ball, but I've never heard Howard say, ever, I don't think, in a team talk, that we wanted to draw, ever. It was always about trying to get a result and try and win the game if we can. Yeah, not to concede, but in the main, it was to try and win the matches. And I look at it sometimes now and I'm thinking, you know, well, what message are people sending out? We don't lose first and we win second. Oh, good teams don't do that. They win first and draw second, and on a bad day you lose. But in the main, you go to win. But a lot of the time nowadays, you go not to lose. So the philosophy in football has changed incredibly, which then makes you players go into their shell because the importance of the games becomes more that they've got more to lose. They haven't. You've still got 3 points. Now, if you're honest, you may as well go out and try and attack and win and see what happens. If you go everywhere and try and hold on, it's a very negative attitude to centre players. So I think the philosophy has changed in football, and everything's all about keeping the ball. Well, at the end of the day, the ball's got to go in the opposition's net, so you can keep it for like 5 hours if you want, but you ain't getting anywhere, are you?
Obviously, you know, I could listen to you all day. I'm quite interested in your point about players not allowed to be themselves. You know, you talk about the, you know, the release valve at the Chinese meals, you know, and allowing players to be themselves. And in the book, one of the areas that you talk about, and I teach this at the college where I work, and we discuss this in one of our football modules, and it's sort of not so much homophobia as being the last taboo in the game, but in the book you talk about, and I'm quite interested in your thoughts on this. You talk about how it's so celebrated in the female game, and it's so hidden in the men's game. And when you talk about players are at their best when they're allowed to be themselves and they're allowed, exactly, to express themselves. You know, I'm just wondering why do you think the female game celebrates it? You know, and does, you're absolutely right, it does celebrate it. It makes icons of their players. And the men's game hide it so much, and it must be to the detriment of some of those players.
Of course it is. Look, if you think there's one person in 10 gay, how many in the first team squad, how many in the staff were not allowed to be who they want to be? Now, part of that is to do to image, part of that is to do with agents, part of that is to do with the fear around that, and part of that is the fact that predominantly, till probably, I don't know, I would say in the last, I think since, I'll have to be honest, since Sky came in, then you start getting women more interested in football. Maybe because it was more accessible on the television, I don't know. But it seemed to be just a men's culture. It was like a working man's club, I think, right up till when Sky come in. Everything was about, you know, when I first got in, they said, whatever you do, never show anybody you hurt. Never show that. Never get up and, you know, complain that you hurt. Just do him next time. So you just grew up with that. You just grew up with that culture, you know. And I think now things, and I think the other thing that's made it a difference is foreign players coming in. Because foreign players aren't quite as, I wouldn't say manly is the right word, but I wouldn't say expected to be. I don't know. A cross between a bouncer and a footballer, I suppose. The manly is actually not so much expected of other people because they're much more comfortable with things. They're not as well. If you look at the countries like Italy, they don't care really about all that sort of stuff. You know, Spain don't care. The Dutch players, there's nothing they haven't seen probably. Do you know what I mean? Even walking down the road at night, there's probably nothing. So they're used to it. You know, and don't forget, before we had this much technology, you just listened to the people around your place. And when I was growing up, everyone knew sort of who they used to call the strange fella or the queer fella in the town. And now with technology, the kids have seen everything. You know, they can get everything at the click of a button, and they grow up with a different outlook on life, that things aren't as taboo as they used to be. And I think that's a really good thing. I think the advent, which much as I don't like Sky that much, it's helped bring more women into the game. I think it was a man's culture, and now it's not. But I would still like the Premier League, especially, is to make sure they go around every club and they sign a letter to say they would be really happy if somebody came out as gay in the men's league, and then they would back it 100%. And if they didn't sign it, I'd want to know why they wouldn't sign it, and then I would send them away for some extra learning, because I think they need that. Now, there's no reason why 100% of Premier League footballers and staff would not sign that letter, and that would help the players who were on, you know. Look, there's only two ways these players are going to come out. One of the papers is going to slaughter them, so they've got to jump before they're pushed. And two, we create an environment in which it's great to do. And I'd rather create the environment where it's great to do rather than, you know, be pushed into doing something they don't really want to do, not comfortable. But if we've already got that atmosphere, you know, through, and everybody knows, and everybody works round the ground for that. See, you've still got to remember that calling somebody a queer doesn't get them sent off. Calling somebody the N-word gets them sent off. So there's a discrimination in that as well. So I do think we need to look at that. I think the FA should come out and tell everybody what the procedure is if somebody wants to come out, because again, the FA agree to being reactive and not proactive. If you've got things in place and they sit on Sky and they tell everybody what it is, and we say, once this happens, blah, 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 it's a really positive thing to be doing. But at the moment, because you keep burying the head in the sands, you know, it ain't going to go away. And the first one who comes out is going to be a multi-millionaire. And that's the plus side of it. If you look further down the line, we've got going to have a massive, massive problem with trans players. Because that's in the future as well. Because if gay people come out and they're really seen as the norm, you know, if you've got to remember that black players were at this stage at some point. You know, black players, like Cyril Regis, were getting bullets through the post. Now, if we get to the same stage as the black players now, where there's gay players in playing for England and all Ireland, Scotland, then obviously, surely the next step is going to be for trans footballers to come through, or trans sports people to come through, which they are in other sports, really. And then there's a lot of them I speak to who find it incredibly difficult to get on because, you know, if they go and play in the girls' leagues, the girls don't like them and want to kick shit out of them because in their eyes they're not a man, they're not a lady. If you get it in the other way, then people don't like it. So if you've got a trans kid, when there's more than ever now, who is six and an outstanding footballer, where do you place them? And there's going to be a whole generation of sports people that are not going to be able to do this sport because nobody can make up their mind. And which is mad, again, because nobody's thinking about it or nobody's having a look. Because I'm 100% convinced that eventually in this country we're going to have to sit down and decide what a man and a woman is, which sounds slightly crazy, but we're going to have to decide what a man and a woman is. Now, if you're a trans lady and you're got a man's name on your birth certificate, I don't, you can only get insurance in that name as far as I know. So on one thing you've got to be a man, and another thing you can be who you really are. Now, if we're saying that to be whatever you can be, you have to be yourself, then we need to look at what it is. What is a man and what is a woman? Now, to me, trans women and women, trans fellas and fellas. That to me is simple. But there's a certain group of people in this world who think otherwise and for some reason are obsessed with toilets with them. Absolutely obsessed. I think if, you know, a trans woman goes into the toilet, the first thing she's going to do is try and get on top of everybody else in the toilet. You know, so we have to start talking about things in the open, but not have an agenda. So the agenda should be like what's best for everybody, not sort of best for a certain group. And I think at the moment, this country's got into a position where we're not doing what's best for everybody. We're doing what's best for a certain section. You know, and when you look at the government, they've divided this country down to the have-nots and the haves. The blacks and the whites, if you like, they've divided the country into all of that. They've now become, you know, the asylum seekers have become the enemy, which they never were. And his quote this week where he said, they've all got to go back, and I'm thinking every asylum seeker has a right to have their case heard on a case-by-case basis. But no, they've all got to go back because he's already said that they're wrong. Now, how does he know? Because he doesn't speak to them. You know, people keep telling me that asylum seekers come over here for the money. Well, I know how much benefit they get, and I wouldn't travel through six countries across the channel for 70-odd quid a week or 90 quid a week. I mean, if it's a simple case of that, then the government would just send the money to their country and give them 70 quid a week and everyone's happy. There's no problem. The reason is because we've got a great country and we haven't covered the country in houses. We've still got loads of land. But surely that if somebody's in trouble, then we need to help them out. The problem is, with gender, nobody wants to speak about it. With sex workers, nobody wants to speak about it. With immigration, nobody wants to speak about it. With racism, nobody wants to speak about it. Unless they have a vested interest in it, and then they push their particular view. But what we need to do is have sensible people sat around the table and go, actually, look, what's best for the country? What's best for these people? And how can we help? But we do it the other way.
So, Neville, do you think not like schemes like Everton in the community at the moment where they've got teams of asylum seekers, refugees, they're trying to get the LGBT community a lot more involved in the activities of the football club? Do you feel more Premier League clubs and more league clubs should be involved actively in promoting those type of programmes?
Yeah, I think so. But I mean, you know, if you take Everton for example, I've spoke to time.
Yeah.
Right. Now, we did have an agreement where they were going to go and play next to the women's pitches.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm saying, get them on the pitch at Goodison at half time. I've already spoke to Arsenal, the Gay Gooners, they're great.
Yeah.
And they have a little five a side on the pitch at half time. Yes. Because there's beer in the stadium, because people come with empty heads, there's going to be a little bit of stuff around the ground, you know, that. But eventually that'll become the norm. Yeah. So on Rainbow Laces Day, surely it'd be better to have people on the pitch and then you go, oh, yeah, well, so what? Eventually, they'll just go, so what? And eventually, we will have, when the kids come through, the kids don't care. So, once the demographic of the fans change too, then I think people accept it. And the more they accept the pitch, the better it is.
I think you make a really good point there, Neville, about the view of the younger generation, how they're much more accepting of sort of the LGB community than what other older sections of society are as well. And I think that that's where the future lies, in education and in community football programmes.
But if you say we really support LGBT and we'll get the rainbow laces and we'll put them in the dressing room and then whoever wants to wear them can wear them, which is fine, it's a free choice. But you can't play on our pitch at half time. Matt said that's not right. But if you said, well, we're really behind this, go and play on the pitch. Now, if you take that stage further, and now and again you said, well, okay, well, let's have the Simon Seekers on the pitch, do you think people are going to be that bothered? They'll just get used to people coming on the pitch and they'll go, yeah, okay, just passes me pint and me by. Yeah. You know, so it becomes a couple. What you're doing then, right, is you're building a platform for your first Everton player to come out. It's not about what about these will be basically stepping stones for whoever comes out. So if the Rainbow Toffees play on there a fair bit, then everyone will go, well, that club's accepting that. So what will happen then is we've got anybody who's gay within the club who wants to come out. Makes it easier because they know everybody's there and it's acceptable to go on a pitch. You've got a player in the academy, the youth section, first team, who feels it's necessary that he wants to come out. Then people are all. It's not going to be a big shock, is it? It's not. We're building a platform, and these people will all be stepping stones to that day when that person comes out on the pitch and he runs out in the first team shirt. Surely that's got to be a good thing. And you're not telling me that somewhere along the way we're going to sign an asylum seeker, and he's going to be in the first team eventually, and everyone's going to go, yeah, we're immigration sharing, and we should have all these people in this country. Oh yeah, he's great. He's great. Yeah, he's number nine. Yeah, he's fantastic. He scored 30 goals for us. Yeah, but he came over on a boat. Yeah, well, it doesn't matter really, does it? Because he's one of ours now. So he becomes one of ours. You know, all of a sudden he's there. Now, it's a crazy world when that can happen. But we look at the refugees and the people who come over on boats as enemies. But in fact, they're doctors, dentists, teachers, whatever, they can add to society. They don't all have to be, they're not all trafficking people. They're not all trafficking prostitutes. They're not all gangsters. There's some really good people amongst them. And yet we seem to think, or the Prime Minister seems to think that we need to send them all back because they're all bad. And if you don't talk to them, how do you know?
I'll chat about this all day. You know, Stephen, you know, obviously, you know, the stuff that's covered in the book, there's so much in the way of contemporary issues. And, you know, we've talked, you and I have talked about how, you know, football reflects society and society is reflected in football.
Yeah, for me, it does. But, you know, it comes down to tolerance versus intolerance, doesn't it? It's, you know, it's having that open-mindedness that Neville speaks of. Yeah, you know, and you know, I'd be interested in Neville's take on, and he has already spoke of that sense of how footballers are kind of, it's almost like they've got a stereotype to live up to, or certainly used to do. You know, hopefully that breaks away now. But it's that, like, and Drew Broughton, who we had on the podcast, who wrote fantastic books, yeah, spoke of so well and so eloquently, was this sense of strength, and how strength is kind of bracketed in the wrong way, that, you know, you're not meant to show any weaknesses, and any kind of confessional that any player is deemed to come forward with is seen as a weakness rather than a strength. I'd be interested to know Neville's take on that demographic within his own dressing room of the, without naming any names, but the, that concept that, you know, a player in a dressing room who is, you know, a sensitive soul or intelligent or open-minded, the player that would bring in the broadsheet newspaper rather than the tabloid. You know, at Liverpool we had Michael Robinson, for instance, you know, and it, you know, he was, it would not be frowned upon, but he was given a cockeyed look because he'd be talking about world politics and issues. Pat Nevin exactly the same way. Graham was so later on, and these players took certain amounts of stick for it. You know, do you think we're moving away from that slowly but surely?
I don't know, really.
The world of the alpha male, isn't it? It's these you know, intelligent, yeah, thinkers within what is basically a very alpha male environment.
Yeah, but I think everybody wears a mask. So when you can appear an alpha male, it doesn't mean you are an actual alpha male. I think some situations like the dressing room, the dressing room is very, well, not, when I looked at Mourinho's or Spurs' documentary, it seems to have gone a little bit away from that, but it's gone from basically man's man in a dressing room to, you know, multicultural, really. So the football's the only thing that binds a lot of them together. And I do think, even in our dressing room, what you necessarily dread in the dressing room, it's not necessarily what you thought.
Yeah.
So I think everybody's the same in that. You know, you can go to work and you fit in with work, and when you come home, you go to your missus, I can't believe what you said today, you little bollocks. And then you go, yeah, but you joined in, didn't you? And you go, yeah, well, I did. So there's a bit of that. I think people are afraid. See, we've got this thing where we're afraid of everything. We're afraid of being a man's man, and we're afraid of being too hard. We're afraid of being too soft. So it comes back to the same thing to me. Why can't you just be yourself? If you're yourself, who cares? I don't care what. And look, Andy Gray was mad. He'd headbutt somebody's head if they could head the ball in the net. You know, it was just mad. Pat Nevin had the weirdest sense of humour you've ever seen in your life, and yet read some of the most intelligent things. Maybe that's what drove him mad, because he read the Telegraph. I don't know. But there's certain things I think that you like, or like Pat probably stuck out more than ever, because he did appear to be intelligent. and all. But I always work on the basis of that he was that intelligent, he wouldn't bite five people and fall over, would he? He'd beat five people and cross the board, probably. But he is, and he's got a great sense of humour. Do you know what I mean? But he's very he was very intense. Now, Graeme Lasseau was another one. I watched him on the telly and I hated him. And I went to do something with him. I thought, I'm going to hate this fella. And I come on, I said, "Mum, oh, I can't believe that. He's actually a really nice geezer." I thought, I've hated him for about 6 years. That's just wrong, isn't it? And I think that was another learning curve for me, was that I had this image of him, you know, good to have in your team, but an absolute pain in the arse to play against. And I think when you get on, you're okay. But I do think we're fed so much stuff of how we should be. You know, take Sky Sports, right? And I'll say this about you three. You look different, right? tell me how many reporters and how many presenters look different on Sky. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's an image for Sky that you have to be smart suit, sort of youngish, just finished the game now. You can see where the call he had this week. You know, not long finished, so everybody knows who you are. All the women look the same. And it's the image that they portray, that they want to portray. And each thing has an image, and each magazine has images. And we go back to the same thing that's gone on for years and years and years and years. It's the same thing. We feed our kids images. We shouldn't be feeding our kids images. We should be saying, look, be yourself. We feed the adults, you know, you should. If you haven't bought this car, you're a complete failure. Yeah, but 70 grand, mate. I only get 10 grand a year in my wages. Yeah, but you're a complete failure if I've got this car, this hybrid, that can do everything apart from sort of drive itself, or then now it can drive itself. So I do think it's real. We need to get back to what's important. And I think if anything that the lockdown's taught you, is they're saying there's more mental health than ever. Now, that means really, in effect, that we either need to socialise a lot, which humans do, or we're not completely happy with ourselves. I know, why aren't we completely happy with ourselves? Because we're told there's something wrong with us every single day. You get a tube of toothpaste 1 week, and it's the best ever. Next week, they've got a better one. But they still sell you the other one. They don't just stop making it because they've got a newer version. So they say, oh, you need this for your hair, you need this for your skin. You need this for your feet. You need this for this. Oh, man, and it's getting to a point where you're saturating. You have to have certain things. And I think the pressure on young children, especially now, on young adults that I see now, is that they have to have it now. You know, in the old days, your mum would say, or your dad say, well, save up for it, you ladies. Can you get a job and save up for it and do it? But it's not that kind of world anymore. It's moved on to an instantaneous world. So I think it's all had a knock-on effect. And now, as a society, we're not sure what we should be. Should we be men's men? Should we be nice, soft, caring people? Or should we be incredibly, like, everything offends us? And we're so mixed up at the moment because nobody knows. There's no proper... Look who we've got in charge. We've got a liar, a homophobic, racist, sexist man. And he's in charge of the country. And then we've got some trained fella who's is bad. So if we've got the role models in them jobs, how are we expecting them, our kids, to grow up? If he was in my school, he'd be excluded for the stuff he said. But we somebody's voted him in. And then we've got party and personal gain before the country. And I think we need to get back to a politics where the politicians actually work for the country and what's best for all, not just for their own little ends. See, Labour have got a massive problem at the moment because they know the businesses will not follow Labour. So they've got to win the businesses over, and that's going to be hard. Once you win the businesses over, they'll win the people in the street over. But unfortunately, by winning the businesses over, they're going to alienate an awful lot of their fans. So Labour have got a choice now. Do they sort of basically go, yeah, we're going to go business and we're going to go Tony Blair style and we'll get back in and then we can go, well, hey, we'll do whatever we want to do in the first place? or do they go, actually, we're going to stick to our principles, which Jeremy Corbyn did, basically, and it not got money with anyway? Because whoever owns the press owns the country at the moment. It's a very Tory press. So I think we're so mixed up at the moment at the top. For kids and people and normal people going about their business, it's so difficult because there's no lead. You know, if you look at the girl in, was it New Zealand? Prime Minister?
Yeah, Jacinda Ardern, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, come out and spoke sensibly and we'll do this and we'll do that. And there was no, oh, well, this is no good for this party, so we won't do it. I think it's just not, we need to get back to people who care about the country and not care about themselves. You know, take the train, £100 billion train, and yet he's arguing about giving people extra money if they have to stay off work when they have to quarantine themselves. So we're telling you, you can't have any more money off us, and you will have to pay the tax bill. But by the way, I'm spending £100 billion on a train. Well, what sort of message is that? Oh, you're waiting for a cancer operation, yeah, because the hospital's slow right now. Okay. There's £100 billion on a train, yeah, but don't worry about it because in 6 years' time, other people can have a job on it. Won't be you because you'll be dead. I mean, to me, it's just, there's so mixed messages because we don't have a proper agenda for people. And we don't have a proper agenda for people because we've let people into politics who, there seems to be a place now where you can get to become president of the United States just by lying and saying you didn't say it. So you can come on television and say, well, you're all idiots. Vote for me. And the next day, they all vote for him because he says, I never said it. It's just, it's an incredible world at the moment where liars can get to the top of the profession. But not just liars, and blatant liars, where you can show them a camera and say, look what you said in here. And they either walk off or go, well, I didn't mean it. We've got to be careful what we show on our kids and what we're showing people. Because that reflects onto the streets. And that's why you've seen Dominic Cummings going off his holiday in Durham. And everybody else goes, well, that's fine, then we can all do it. So we're getting so many mixed messages. And I think it's really difficult at the moment without ranting about him and Trump. We've got probably the two worst leaders in the world that we've ever had. Nothing to do with football, really, is it?
It's funny. I mean, obviously the four of us are here, you know, because of our love for the game, and you talked about football taking responsibility. Certainly, you talked about the homophobe, but I suppose in the bigger picture, then, in terms of what essentially comes down to sort of healing society, is it going to come from sort of bottom up, you know, with something like football playing a part, schools playing a part, or because clearly, you know, as we've said there, the politicians at the moment either aren't doing it, can't do it, won't do it, whatever those reasons are, you know, is it going to have to come from national entities such as, like, say, football or education?
You know what I think it'll come from? It'll come from somebody you don't expect. And it'll come from somebody who just has the charisma to lead people. Because, like I said before, the BME community don't have a natural leader, do they? Right? Because if they had a natural leader, we'd be having a slightly different conversation now because they'd be listened to. All the working class people and the people in poverty, we haven't got a natural leader. So, but it'll come because it's going to have to come. The people at the top can only get away with stuff for so long before people go, actually, they've had enough. And all we need is a new kind of politics. The trouble is that you see with Jeremy Corbyn, that if the media don't like him, they get slaughtered. But it'll be somebody that won't need the media, and it'll be somebody charismatic that won't need anything, and people will come to him. And I'm convinced it'll either be a man or a woman. Well, be a man or a woman, obviously, but it'll be someone will come from somewhere in a pretty short space of time and will galvanise people. And I think that's going to have to happen. You know, because you could see now, I think we'll have more riots. We'll have more unhappiness. We'll have a police force that's massively underfunded that can't cope. So therefore, there's going to be even more trouble. And I do think it's going to be like a little America over here. You can see it building. You can see the police eventually whatever they say, carrying guns, and you can see more conflict, unless we can actually sit down and talk as grown-ups. And it seems to me, you know, I listen to all the stuff in politics, and you go, well, you know, you say to Trump or something, or Boris Johnson, well, you haven't done very well, and he goes, yeah, but you didn't do very well, did you? Now, that's how we're teaching our kids to argue. Now, I thought Parliament was supposed to be like a proper debate. Yes, your points score, but your points score by bringing out facts, and the facts speak for themselves. But at the moment, we go, yeah, but you said that, yeah, but you said that. And that's a sum total of our politics. And yet there's thousands upon thousands of good people in this country working really, really hard to make a difference. Yet they don't have a voice. Now, football clubs, unfortunately, have gone away from working class people, because the working class can't afford to keep paying their money into corporate stuff. Yes, people will buy their season tickets, they'll buy their shirts, but to fill your corporate boxes and your hospitality, they need a different clientele. So that clientele is completely different. So, you know, it just divides again the hospitality and the stuff to the other end of the market.
And you said before, sorry, it's up in there, that you couldn't play in the modern game because of the way the players have to have an image, etc. Could you play in the modern game with the type of crowds that we get these days, where it is overwhelmingly a middle class, affluent audience compared to the one that you played in, which is more working class and passionate?
I suppose if I didn't know better, I probably could, because a crowd's a crowd. But, you know, again, we have the best psychologist, and yet nobody works with a crowd. We've got 40,000 people on our side. So I don't think we work hard enough. I don't think football in general works hard enough in motivating the crowd. They leave the crowd alone. And yet, that's your biggest weapon, is your crowd. We don't do enough around the ground and inside the grounds. You know, because we come into the game and you go, right, okay, we've got West Ham at home. We should beat West Ham at home. Right? But the philosophy around the ground and the way things are at the moment is nobody's sure we're going to beat West Ham, because we're all up and down. We don't know what sort of team we're going to get. So what we need to do is to make sure that whatever happens in that, on that pitch, the crowd thing is separate, and that we keep it motivated. So yeah, I'd like to see what they do in Holland and have a band in the crowd. Mm. And I would, for some of the games, I'd employ a couple of choirs, and I'd make sure they'd sing and they kept the atmosphere going during the games. I'd make sure there was a little band outside the grounds going round on a car, playing music. So everything was geared that whatever happened, you'd walk away from that game with a good feeling. It's a real entertaining day. You know, it's like Rainbow Laces Day, isn't it? So what did he do? What happens? You know, why can't we have Liverpool Pride that go round the two grounds as part of their walk when there's a matches on, and then they can go into town? Look, how can we include them? We look as if we've got two sacred places that we're shit scared of letting anybody else into. And yet, if a football club is truly a heart of the community, then we should be inviting people in and not pushing them away. Look, and I have to say that for both clubs, they do brilliant, and Everton in particular that I know about do fantastic work. But there's still things that you can be doing that don't cost you a lot of money. You know, and I think, you know, giving a corporate box away for a season to give it to local charities to bring people in would be a start. And hopefully in a new ground they can have a section, or they can have one box where they can give away to charity every single week. And not the big charities, because they got the money anyway. The little charities, so they can invite people in that they've never had a chance to actually get in front of people and build the smaller charities up. I mean, I've spoken to them quite a lot, I have to say, in the past year or so. You know, and I want to go back and I want to work in the community if I can with them. That's one of my aims, if I can do it. But they've been quite receptive so far, I have to say, and it's just trying to sort of find a connection or something we can do together, which I think would be really good. So I've come from the outside in, if you like. I've come from outside, but the connections I've made through Twitter and everything, I know I can bring an awful lot into the club, what they haven't done. You know, and Twitter's a powerful, powerful medium, to be fair. And the connections I made are just really, really good for me. You know, my eventual aim is to, while I work in the school, is to try and do a bit with Everton, but also try and go along the lines. I want to try and qualify as a counsellor if I can, and then do something with suicide. I'd like to try and do the negotiation side of suicide, where you can go and be called and try and talk people out of it, if you like. That's where I'm aiming to go, if I can. The other stuff, the football stuff, but the football, even though all the stuff has changed around football, all the jargon that Sky have brought in, you know, between the lines and that shit, that'll football's never changed. Football's about 11 people on a pitch trying to be better than the others. As a coach, you make them 11 people better. If you can't, you get the sack, but you have to be given time to get your players and your staff. But football's about people. And we keep going on about technology. You know, we show them all this technology. It gives a shit what you show me. It's no good showing me like 15 films, is it, if I can't take the information in? One, is it the right information you're giving me? Two, is it within my learning style? Three, have I got the ability to think like that? Four, am I going to be motivated enough to do it? So for me, every football club and every business is geared by their recruitment. And if you haven't got your recruitment right, you're wasting your time anyway. You three will probably work together well. If you had somebody with shit with you, you'd have to cover for them. That'd make your company or your podcast horrendous. So you look at who you recruit to work with. And we've done, well, most football clubs have done incredibly badly doing that. And hence we're in the situation where we are. But I will say about Everton, it's probably the best time to be an Evertonian ever. We've got a world-class manager who can attract world-class players. We've got a new ground on the horizon, and we can't afford commercially to go on that pitch with a shit team. Because if we do, there won't be a big crowd. They won't sell their hospitality. They won't sell their corporate stuff. So it's geared to having a better team. Probably you're looking at six in the league at the absolute minimum, and Champions League or the league within 5 years ago, isn't it? And that's why it's a good thing.
But as you're saying, Neville, I mean, when you played in the 80s, you know, can you imagine have a candle in the spine of the team by saying, if we play well this season, lads, we're going to finish sixth?
Well, I can't understand anybody who goes into their training ground pre-season and goes, it's going to be great if we stay up.
Yeah.
Surely you want more than that. Surely you, but people are afraid to say it. You know why they're afraid to say it? Because they come back and people laugh at you. People laugh, who gives a shit? So if I don't say it, see, when I go to Goodison, right, and I listen to the people, they're no longer sure what's going to happen. So we have to change the mindset and the philosophy. So we have to have the philosophy of the club. And we have to choose the manager to fit in with that philosophy and the players to fit in with that philosophy of the club. You don't change the whole club for one person. You have your philosophy of how you want to play and the type of player that's an Everton player. And you only have them type of players, and you only produce them type of players, because them players are going to be the best and going to win you the league. But only doing it as Everton. West Ham have got theirs, and that's why West Ham fans go mad. Everton go mad. Why do you think Sam Allardyce got slaughtered? It wasn't because he was a particularly bad manager, because the things around him were, well, he just plays defensive, and he came in, and instead of saying, tell you what, I'm going to go for Europe, he came in and said, I'm going to tell you what, I'm going to save you from relegation. But we're not going down. We were never going down, yeah, but I'm going to save you from relegation. So it's a message you give out. Now, if I walk into the ground and everybody in that ground believes we've got a chance of winning the league, or we want to win the league, and we're geared to win the league, and from the tea woman who served you the tea and is really buzzing because that club's going to win you the league, to the top should be the same message. Now, if you sit in the boardroom at the top, I don't know what goes on up there, to be fair. They've got a vision, which they have, a new ground and obviously a better team, and you've got a great manager. Then please share that vision with the people, because I think if everybody buys into that philosophy, what's worse is having no ambition and failing, or having ambition and failing anyway.
Exactly, Neville. I mean, do you think that were you frustrated by the fact that you found it difficult to get into football management when your career finished?
No, because I didn't think I was ever going to get in there, really.
And why would that be?
Because I'm not diplomatic, am I?
we have noticed.
I don't know what you mean.
I was never going to get on with people who just... You know, I got a sack at Hastings and a fella told me it was because we trained on a Monday and a Thursday. And we were fourth in the league with a game in hand on the top spot. And that was it. So that's just, you know, just the way it is, isn't it? I was never, do I want to be a manager now? Would I like to mentor some of the younger goalies? Not training, but just be on the end of a phone from, yeah, probably something like that. I did a thing with all the Spurs goalies not so long back, because Paul Bracewell asked me to do it. So I did that, and it was quite interesting. See, to be a good coach or whatever, you have to know how the other person thinks. Mm. Yeah, with the goalkeepers, it's different. I want to know, say for instance, Jordan Pickford, what is going through his mind on a one-on-one? What is going through his mind when the other goalie gets a ball? And I want to see how he thinks, because everybody's fit and everybody's got talent. But none of you can do anything. You can't move a muscle without your brain. It's just impossible. So you have to look, get inside the head and go, right, okay, what are you thinking about? Tell me what you think. Tell me what you see. And then you got an idea of what they're going through and what they're seeing and what they're thinking about. And sometimes it doesn't need much to actually change what they do. And I think people, look, I can get a sheepdog to do drills, and a monkey to do drills, but you're talking about people here. So for when you coach people, you have to know each person really, really well. And I think in a 25-man squad, I think that's difficult. It's like a teacher in a class. So I think mentoring the kids, I don't want to have them look at it. I think it'd be good.
Would you ever consider working for the FA? I know that's quite the question. But obviously, you seem to have an incredible perception about what's going on in the world. You have perception from playing the game and being around the game as to what football can and can't offer. You know, you sort of mentioned, you know, about taking the lead, about making it acceptable for players to come out. And you're right, that's got to come from the FA. But, you know, as we've sort of heard, you've alluded to, there isn't really anybody of your ilk that works in the FA.
They have a charity called Stonewall, which is the LGBT charity. And they do okay, to be fair. But I just think we're too staid in our approach to everything. Mm. We don't look for problems. We only react to problems. And you want to be looking for problems all the time to solve. Look at this pandemic, right? How many people do you think on Facebook and Twitter the Premier League clubs have? Millions?
Yeah.
Right? You take Jamie Carragher, who's probably got, 2.5 million? You take Gary Neville, who's probably got 4 and a bit million. Why didn't they go to them from the NHS and say, look, we'll use the clubs as NHS ambassadors. We'll use these players that we've got as ambassadors. And we will make sure that we tweet everything through them to get the message to everybody that it's what we have to do. Now, it's cost them nothing but a tweet, and you get through to 20 million people. Right, you've got things that doesn't cost any money whatsoever, why aren't the NHS now going to the club and saying, look, be our ambassadors. Every time we want to get a message out to the kids, we'll use you. Because it's far cheaper and far more effective and far more widespread than anything they're doing now. Because whenever I speak to our kids and say, well, you know, when you go to doctors, you pick up the leaflets. No, we just Google it if there's something wrong with us. So to get messages out there from their heroes, they're going to take more notice of it than there's some geezer in a white tunic stood in front of them with Boris Johnson. There's none of them kids watch all that shit. It's what news. So if you're looking to get into people and in messages across to young people, then you use people who've got massive followings and you put them as ambassadors and you say, look, tweet this, what's it costing you? Nothing. But you're an NHS ambassador, you're this, for this, we need this. And I think that's a much simpler and a much cheaper way of doing things, and people take more notice. You know, as long as you pick the right people, you're going to have some failures because, you know, not everybody's life runs smoothly. So, but if you pick the right people who've got the right following, you know, you imagine all them people who follow Jamie Carragher and Gary Neville, footballers, but mostly fellas. And you want to get a message out about pancreatic cancer or testicular cancer. What better two people to tweet about it? You're covering 6.5-7 million people in two tweets. How much more can be done through that? That's why I like Twitter and the stuff. Is that there's things out there that cost nothing, just needs a bit of imagination and a bit of work, and get people round the table and say, look, can you do this for us? And what are them two going to say? No, they're not going to say no, are they? No. You've got people you can use for free, who can give the right message out to the right people at the right times. And I think just by doing that would be a massive help. Because let's be honest, does anybody believe anybody from politics on television?
No,
not
me. Basically, right, so if you said, right, Gary Lineker will tweet a tweet, who would you believe, Gary Lineker or Boris Johnson?
Yeah. All day.
Yeah, exactly. Or somebody like that, where they know you're tweeting, and it's an official NHS tweet, and they tweet it. Then it'll get retweeted. So whatever Gary's got, say Gary's got 2 million people. By the time everybody retweets it, you're looking at 3-4 million. Then the people who retweeted will retweet that. You're looking at 6-7 million, and it's a simple thing to do. And it doesn't cost you nothing, and it does so much good. You get to the kids not through politicians. You get them through music, and you get it through entertainment, and you get it through sport. You don't get through to kids by politics. You never do. So you've got to use what you've got, and then people have got to be sat down, and it's got to be coordinated, and it's got to be run properly, and you will absolutely smash them messages in. You know, it's no good the government putting an advert on telly about washing hands, because no one gives a shit, no one cares. Because all they're thinking about is, well, get off, because I want to watch the programme. If they tweet it and they show it, they'll massive difference. And they show themselves doing it. Massive difference. They show themselves, you know, doing whatever. Checking for breast cancer and stuff like that. It makes a massive difference. It's a massive statement. And it costs you zilch. And this is where I think the PFA and the FA need to be using their commodities, if you like, and using the people. And if you look at it again, they should be using Sky, because Sky get through to all the laddie stuff, and it's like BT. They should be using them to promote stuff. You know, I know Jeff Dunham wears his little badge, but in the main, you need them to be working for you. And if you've got all them people working for you, you make a massive difference by nothing, by just a little bit of thought. And I'm sure, you know, I've talked to Evan about this, you know, the Twitter thing. You can make a massive difference. I might imagine Evan turning their Twitter over to a little charity where, you know, say Evan have got, I don't know what they've got, say 3 million on there, and you have a little charity in Liverpool who need funds and need this. Even if 1% help them, that's 1% of 3 million. So it may, by doing little things, can make a massive difference to the community, you know. And I do think on there, you can do wonders with it.
Agreed.
Like I say, I mean, we could talk to, I'm sure, well, certainly I know Paul could. We could talk, you know, we could chat to you all day. You know, we've already gone over your sort of time that we were supposed to be allowed. I'm sorry for keeping you, but please don't feel like you've got to rush off.
Let's do another 10 minutes and then we'll finish. How's that?
All right, perfect. Stephen, do you want to
have just a make the answer really short.
Okay.
No, I think everything that Neville covers here is absolutely valid. And, you know, I'm a great believer that, you know, the society we live in at the minute has never been more divided in my lifetime, at the very least. And I think individuals are massively important, like Neville. And as he said, you know, if a Jamie Carragher or a Gary Neville or, you know, Gary Lineker can push a cause, then it is massively, massively vital, because, you know, people do sit up and take notice. It's like that concept of revolution or evolution, and it's like a subtle evolution. You know, if Neville can say something and shine a light on a subject that matters, should matter to society, and even if just kind of like 10, 15 people sit up and take notice and think, I'm going to read into that. You know, I'll go back to kind of like, you know, being a Liverpool supporter and the arrival of John Barnes, for instance. And he was the first black player we ever signed. We'd had Howard Gale, who came through the ranks, and massive intolerance. I remember Anfield and I remember the racism. But John Barnes arrived, and then suddenly it was very different. And people would listen, you know, people would suddenly listen to the issue and the problem.
Do you think, if John Barnes had been crap, it would have made a difference? Do you think he was brilliant?
Yeah, sadly, I think it probably would have made a difference. Mm. You know, not to everyone. It would have taken a certain mindset for it not to make a difference. Yeah. You know, I've listened to the stuff that kind of like Howard Gale said, for instance, and Howard Gale was a great footballer, but he was limited in the amount of games that he played for Liverpool, but he made a massive impression on me. But that's just me personally. You know, I think now, you know, people listen to him a whole lot more in the wake of kind of like John Barnes. And it's about, for me, the breaking of barriers. And it is just a case of illumination. And I think what Neville does is absolutely fantastic, and is well.
It's stepping stones, isn't it?
You can't have a revolution, and that's the thing that people won't be preached to. You know, sat in front of a classroom, like you say, politician will come in front of the television and say this is how it's meant to be, and people won't listen. But if there's an individual that is well respected by a sizable amount of society. Mm-hmm. That can carry a message, then, you know, the amount of good that can do is epic.
Yeah, you've just got to pick the right person for the right demographic.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you look at Marcus Rashford, for instance, and the influence that he's had of late, and the respect that he's garnering from, you know, and it's that concept of, you know, breaking the divisions. You know, football's so tribalistic, but, you know, well, Neville will be uncomfortable by hearing about this, but, you know, he garners so much respect to supporters, right-thinking Liverpool supporters, right-thinking supporters from the wrong end of the East Lancs Road, for instance, and, you know, all across the spectrum of football, you know, the people who think like he does, you know, are massively, massively impressed with the things that he says. And it's the same with Marcus Rashford and anyone else who would happily stand up and make the voice heard.
Don't you think this is a real massive trouble? See, I think this is the biggest thing that causes problems in Britain, is that there's so many people doing such good stuff, but nobody joins them together.
Yeah, there is. You know, it comes down to, you know, a lack of a collective movement. And there is no collective movement.
Right? From what I can gather, it comes down to, we've got a charity, we get this amount of funding. We don't want to work with anybody else in case Kenya can't fund it. So there's a politics in it. So what I've been trying to do is, I've tried to talk to people about saying, say we get all the suicide charities together. You know, say all the suicide charities in Merseyside, and we say, right, let's sit down here now. and let's work out a rota between us, because that's the other thing with charities, that they don't all work from, well, most of them work from 9 till 5 now, which is all right, but what about the rest of the time? So you have to have a 24-hour care service with a suicide, for instance. Now, if we put them all together and we said, well, let's work out some rotas, let's work out who can get into hospitals quick, let's work out who can be on call to do this, and then what we'll do is we'll sit down with you, we'll bring the NHS in, and we'll give you a blue tick if you pass our knowledge. So you have to do a little, either you're well-trained or you need the training. So we give them a blue tick. So when you come to any A&E and you go, actually, oh, I'm going to kill myself tonight, I'm feeling really bad, and I'm feeling suicidal, you don't say, by the way, there's a 5-hour waiting time in any A&E. You say, I'll phone that number there now and someone will come pick you up in 10 minutes. That's where we need to get to. That's where we need to, you know, we need to band the charities together, because the NHS is going to change. It's going to change massively. So what we need is to start banding these charities together, because if we put all the suicide charities together and then he had their own little council and then he had their little spokesperson, when they go and see whoever's in government at the time and they say, listen, we need more funding or we're going to stop tomorrow, they're going to listen. And this is the problem you've always had with LGBT, is because they have never had a spokesman. The BME have never had a proper spokesman, because no one's got people together. Now, if you get individual charities together, then you've got power. The power is in their voices and what they do. The NHS can't survive without charity. The charity support. And we just need to get all these unbelievable, fantastic people that do charities supporting the NHS in a proper, formalised way. And I think you'd see a massive difference in the number of people waiting for stuff, the number of people who are seen. You know, our kids in school, minimum of 6 months to see an educational psychologist. What are they supposed to do in the meantime? You know, people, you know, I've got a foster kid, his autism assessment took 2.5 years. 2.5 years. And that was, we were expecting 3. So if we can put all these people together and make a plan, then I think we're better. But what normally happens is that we all work in silo. And it doesn't work, does it? Because we're all doing great things in little areas. I'm a really small amount of people on Twitter, really. Now imagine, and I've talked to a lot of people, to be fair, and you wouldn't believe some of their agents won't let them do it. But I wanted 5 or 6 people so I can have 10 million people on Twitter at one time, and we'd then do a takeover on the same night. Now you're hitting 10 million people, and I think that's a good way of doing it. So we can work together. I've asked the AMs in Wales if we could get the Labour Party or the AMs to actually give me one Sunday a month. I haven't got very far with that at the moment, but you know, I will keep bashing on. And the same thing with the phone. You know, why can't a phone come ready with an app on with the Samaritan's number on? And they said, well, you know, it's you know, we can't get all the phone companies. Well, you can. Just ask them. Just have a trial run somewhere. And say, look, all the new phones are going to be bought. Can you put the Samaritan's app on? Because what you'll find in the end is that lots of other people will want their apps on the phones. And it'll pay for itself, I think. And I do think when you go into hospital now, you should be given an app of all the charities that can support whatever you've got. And you've already got it when you go in there. And I think that's a simple way as well. So there's things you can do for literally nothing, but it just needs somebody to organise it all. And there's no way I'm going to organise it all, because I ain't clever enough. So it'll be down to you three.
We've got no chance.
I think we're up for that. Neville, can I just ask you, I think one of the things that inspired lots of people, particularly of my age, is that you kind of created a whole new persona for yourself later on in life. Because I think sometimes once people get past the age of 50, they kind of feel they've lost all that importance in life and society. And I think the way you've generated this whole new audience and given an avenue for your views has been inspirational to so many people.
Well, see, I don't really care.
we kind of noticed that.
See, that's the thing. It's just like people have a like, you know, they don't, and I'm comfortable with what I do and what I am. You know, people come on and say, well, you shouldn't say this on your account. Well,
which one?
I can't say your account. Where can I say it?
Yeah.
My views, if you don't like my views, yeah, block me, I'll move on.
Yeah. It's simple as that, isn't it? I mean, while you're here, Neville, I've got to ask one football question. Obviously, well, I've got the chance for the time runs out. In your opinion, which was the best side, the 84-85 title-winning side or the 86-87 title-winning side? Because they were both completely different teams in different circumstances.
I think the first one's always hardest to win.
Yeah.
I think once you won it once, then the second one, you can draw on the experience of winning the first one. You know, and everybody's been, most of them have been through it. So you've got, which is a double-edged sword, to be fair, because that's why, you know, you have to respect Liverpool and Man United and Man City and the teams that win trophies on a regular basis, because once you win it, you're sort of naive going into it and then you win it. Then you come to the next season, you realise what's at stake because you've won it and you know what it is to lose it. So it becomes a double-edged sword. So the teams that keep winning are fantastic because it's once you've had it in your hands, it's a totally different feel than when you've never had it in your hands. You know what it is to lose. And I think it's really difficult at times, but I do think the first one, there's a bit of naivety. There's a lot of talent. There's a lot of... You've got to remember as well that Howard got every decision right because he won the league. He got every decision right in the cup, the two cups he won. He got every decision right in the Charity Shield. He's got every decision right in the second league that we won. Now, his only decision he got wrong is he buggered off to Bilbao.
Yeah.
Right? That basically killed the club. But, in all fairness, people don't understand how hard it is when you stay with a group of players as long as he did, and Ferguson, and any long-service manager is. It's not so much the day-to-day stuff. It's to stand in front of somebody at 5-3, and then at sort of 3:45 and give the same message in so many different ways. Because basically, you can only give the same message. You know, you can hear manager, you go to Southampton, you go, it's a long way to come, so don't leave with 3 points. Yeah, we can work that out for ourselves. That's not really inspirational. So it's basically saying that in so many different ways, the seasons. And that's where, you know, Ferguson was clever. He kept changing the coaches. So it was a different voice, and then they changed the players. And that would change some of the players. So we had different voices. You know, then you come in at half time, and there's only three scenarios. You're either drawing, you're winning, or you're losing. So there's only three scenarios. And it's how you fix it, but it's how you say how you fix it, because basically it's the same things that go wrong all the time. So you know how to fix it, but you have to say it in a way that's meaningful at each time and makes sense each time, and it doesn't. The players don't become complacent. Listen to it. You know what? Under Mike Walker, come in and went, "You're not fit." That was his answer to everything. Now, you know, when he first came in, that was a fair comment because he hadn't been in charge of us. You know, when he came towards the end of the season, we were all right. Then the next season, he trained his pre-season, but said exactly the same things. Well, if we're not fit, it's his fucking fault, isn't it?
Yeah, because
he's trained us.
But that's because he's on the Sun Lounge all the time, wasn't it?
Well, it's because he kept saying the same stuff and he had nothing else to give. Now, that's a manager with no knowledge, as far as I'm concerned. So he loses respect to the players. Look, he's the only manager that nobody picked in a five side. So he couldn't even cheat properly.
Not even his goalkeeper.
No, because he said, "Oh, I'll go on your side," but no, you won't. and he went to snort just because so nobody'd have him on his team. Now, normally, the manager is the best cheat, so you're guaranteed a win. Because you know you win, you don't have to do anything extra after the game. He never got picked in any of it. Look, not to say he wasn't a nice fella off it. He was okay off it, but, you know, when you look at somebody for knowledge, and this is how I always think about when I think of myself. I was like him. I could stand in front of somebody and talk a tiny bit about somebody and have no real knowledge. But if I had somebody come on my Twitter who lived that experience or knew all about that, that was better than me talking. So that's one of the reasons why I got the takeovers going, is because I realised that I know a tiny bit about everything, but I've never lived it. So when I looked at Mike and I listened to Mike, I said, but you have no knowledge, no in-depth knowledge. And I thought, that's me. That's me stood there thinking I could talk about trans people for at least 30 seconds and I'd be dead. But if you have a trans person come on and say, well, this is how it is for me, that's far better. So what I've learned is that, yeah, I'm a bit dumber in lots of things than I thought, but clever enough to think I've got to get somebody else to talk. So for me, a Twitter takeover is done by people who have either lived the experience, or have the experience. And that way it's a proper takeover where people get some out. And, you know, we've had good results. You know, the stem cell stuff has done really, really well. You know, we had them come on, about Gary Stevens' lad as well, you know, to try and find a match. So the things go well. You're going to get the odd idiot, but in the main, they go well because people are interested. Some of them I can't get to do a takeover, believe it or not. I mean, I've tried for some people, they don't answer back. You know, being with Unison as well, I tried to get somebody on to talk about Venezuela from their point of view. They never even answered me. And I thought, that's a bit strange.
Yeah.
And then I thought, do I go into the Israeli-Palestinian thing? I thought, that absolutely not. you can't find a neutral position, can you?
Yeah.
No matter what your own thoughts are, how do you find a neutral position for that? You just can't. So you're either going to be accused of one or the other. So, you know, it's been good because I've been able to get people on like the Kent Trust who work with the asylum seekers when they come off the boat and they take them off the boat and stuff. So it gives people an insight of what actually happens to them. They go to the detention center. You know, the refugees at home, where they try and rehouse some of the young kids. So it's been good that way. But in the main, it's worked out well for me because every time they're on, I get a break. Yeah, but which is the most important bit? Is that if you don't get a break, you're no good to anybody, are you? So like a footballer, you need to know when to rest and when to protect yourself and when you can do what you can do. And I think that's just like life, isn't it? You've got to remember, for all the afternoon games, you used to have a sleep in the afternoon, so at schools sometimes it's a terrific battle to try and stay awake after 2 o'clock. So, is there anything else you need to ask me?
Like I say, we could talk to you for hours, but I'm so, I'm sure we're all so, so grateful for the amount of time that you've spent with us. It's been an incredible hour and a half. Stephen, enjoyed it?
Oh, it's been a brilliant 90 minutes, which, you know, I think is the perfect...
Very apt.
...rounded, very apt, very apt number of minutes, I think. But, Neville, thanks. You've been absolutely fantastic. Wonderfully candid and just a joy to talk to.
Paul, thank you. Had a good time?
Yeah. Loved every second of it. Can we do it again next Saturday? I could talk to Neville for hours, and both about his football and about his politics. I mean, you know, the best goalkeeper I ever saw in Everton jersey, and also one of the men most respected in club and society these days.
Absolutely, yeah, great.
We can all do stuff. You can do stuff, can't you?
Indeed.
But see, Men to Army, right, on Twitter.
Yeah.
Men to Army. They do mental health qualifications. 30 hours it will take you.
Yeah. No, cheers, Neville. I mean, I do try to retweet all your stuff as well. I'm sure the guys, you know, from the Football Times do as well, to try and spread it to a wider audience.
But things like that are always good, and I think, you know, just a message here and there. Open University were brilliant.
Yeah.
The free courses on there, there's about 800.
Yeah. Marvellous.
It's like I say,
you'd be surprised. You can make a difference to your listeners.
Yeah.
Guaranteed. And I'll guarantee, right, that you've probably saved their life.
What makes it worth doing?
Wonderful. Look,
I know we have on Twitter, right? I know for a fact we have. And I know we can double that because the people that listen or read it. Now, you have got to remember that you might be the only person's voice in that room at night. You might not have spoke to anybody else all day. And all of a sudden your voice comes on. And that voice can make a difference between them having a really bad night and them having a great night. So it does, what you do makes a massive difference. Even though I know it's a bit of fun and stuff like that, whenever somebody puts it on, there's somebody in the room with them. There's a normal life going on in that room, and that's why things like yours are really important. You know, there's a lot of Evertonians and Liverpool people who live on their own, who are going through bad times and need something else. And that is what you provide. So while your message is really good and stuff like that, remember the other side of what you do. And you do make a massive difference, even though you don't think about it. You are in people's homes and in people's lives, and that's why I think you've saved lives.
Thanks,
Neville.
Incredible. Obviously, you know, it's been 90 minutes of chat. The books, I won't say the book's even better because this has been brilliant, but, you know, the book's out 17th of September, and it's, like I say, you know, Neville called it not a biography. That's fine. It's his book. He can call it what he likes. I'm certainly not going to argue with him. That is
that's more like Chim and Mao's thoughts.
There you go. And it is just as profound. You've got to get a copy. It's incredible.
Yeah, highly recommend it.
Incredible. All that's left for me to say is, obviously, on behalf of everyone at These Football Times, again, you know, thanks, Neville, for joining us. Please join us again next time. I can't promise it'll be as good a guest, but please join us again next time on the Love Podcast with These Football Times. Cheers, Neville. Right. Thanks.
See you later. Bye.
See you later. Bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.